Today at Reader's Corner, Jill Jones talking about her book, Eiffel's Tower, the thrilling story behind Paris's beloved monument and the extraordinary World's Fair that introduced it.
Eiffel was an enormously successful engineer. When the French government called for submissions into this contest for what would be the centerpiece of the fair, Eiffel's firm entered this idea. Most people had never been up very high, and even if you'd been up high on a mountain, that really wasn't the same as being up high on the Eiffel Tower. The fair occupied 229 acres, and it was, you know, really a glorious feast for the eyes and ears and senses. People just loved it.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's hard to imagine Paris today without the Eiffel Tower. Yet when Gustave Eiffel proposed building it as a centerpiece for the 1889 World's Fair, he was greeted with criticism. Style-conscious Parisians derided his plan as too ostentatious. The city's famous artists called it boorish and industrial, and many of Eiffel's fellow engineers claimed it would collapse in the first stiff wind. Jill Jones recounts Eiffel's triumph in her book, Eiffel's Tower, the thrilling story behind Paris's beloved monument and the extraordinary World's Fair that introduced it. On this holiday weekend, we are featuring an encore edition of our interview with Ms. Jones. Her book is a fascinating account of Paris in the late 19th century, when Eiffel held court atop the tallest structure in the world, while a remarkable host of artists and personalities, including William Cody, Annie Oakley, and Thomas Edison, mixed, mingled, and made their mark. Ms. Jones is a former journalist and National Endowment for the Humanities scholar and the author of two books about the Gilded Age in America. She joined us by phone for this interview. Jill Jones, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, delighted to be there. Hello, Idaho.
All right. Well, so what is it about the Eiffel Tower that got you going on this book?
Well, very honestly, I had read a wonderful book by an author named Ross King called Brunelleschi's Dome, which is about the building of the Cathedral Dome in Florence. And I thought, gosh, this monument, these books about monuments, this is really wonderful. And so I just was looking for a monument to write about, and it turned out that the Eiffel Tower, there hadn't been anything written about it in decades. And I actually lived in Paris as a young girl and had been to Paris many times. And so the Eiffel Tower was very familiar to me. And once I then further found out that the Eiffel Tower had been built as the centerpiece of this really delightful Exposition Universelle, so the World's Fair of 1889, then I just thought, this is such a wonderful story with this incredible cast of characters. When I found out that Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley and the Sioux Indians had come across on this steamboat and essentially, you know, won over the hearts of the Parisians, I just thought, well, this is going to be great fun. And I have to say, it really was.
Well, the book reminded me of another book I read about a World's Fair, The Devil in White City.
I consider that the highest compliment, because that was a terrific book.
Yeah, well, you really did a great job with this, just as Eric Larson did. And the interesting thing that I remember about that book is that George Ferris, who invented the Ferris wheel and put the first one up ever at that fair, did so as an effort to try to outdo Eiffel.
Yes, well, so most people do not know this. It's a long-forgotten fact. But in the mid-1880s, when the French Republic decided that they were going to host this big World's Fair a few years hence, in 1889, the tallest building in the world was the Washington Monument. It was 500 feet tall, and Americans were very, very proud of this fact. And so when Eiffel and the French announced that as the centerpiece of this fair, they were going to build a 1,000-foot tower, because that is how tall the Eiffel Tower is, the Americans were really unhappy, and especially because both Americans and the British had been talking for many years about building a 1,000-foot tower. I mean, part of Eiffel's genius was that he actually figured out how to do this. I mean, no other design that anyone had put forth was realistically ever going to you know, actually stay up. So the Americans were very unhappy about this, and from the very beginning, they were already talking about how whatever they built in Chicago, because they knew they were going to be having their own fair coming right up after Paris, somehow it had to be better than the Eiffel Tower. And the one small aspect of consolation to the Americans who were very jealous of the Eiffel Tower was that the Otis Elevator Company, based in New York, built one of the elevators, which no French firm had been willing to bid on. And that elevator went on the curved leg that took you up to the second floor.
And then from the second floor, you take a lift all the way up.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, if we could talk for a moment about the idea of the Eiffel Tower. We know, of course, and in a moment I'd like you to help us understand how it was constructed. But before it was constructed, was it Eiffel himself that came up with the idea, or was it Eiffel who was given the idea and then said, somebody said, go build it?
Well, so Eiffel was an enormously successful self-made, mainly railroad bridge engineer, but he was an all-round engineer, and he had a global empire. And so when the French government called for submissions into this contest for what would be the centerpiece of the fair, Eiffel's firm entered this idea. And it was actually designed not by Eiffel, but by one of his architects and working with another engineer. And Eiffel then literally bought the idea from these men. I mean, he always acknowledged that, you know, it was their idea, but he further refined it. And many people would acknowledge that without Eiffel, it would never have been built. And the actual details of how it was constructed was, you know, really based on his plan. And moreover, if you know anything about Eiffel as a bridge engineer and you look at these bridges, I mean, he was the person who came up with the designs for these bridges. And what was unusual about them was that they were very, very tall. They would span these huge gorges, and they could not only handle the weight of these, you know, huge trains, but they could withstand wind. And that was the great challenge for people who were looking to put up a 1,000-foot structure, was how would it resist really, really high winds. So, no, Eiffel did not come up with the original design, but I think by and large people feel that that original design would never have made it into real life but for him.
I know from my days in Chicago going up in the Hancock and the Sears Towers that they tell you that the buildings actually do sway a bit. Does the Eiffel Tower sway a bit?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, because it's all open work, when the wind is blowing through it, it's not hitting something solid. I mean, it's passing through. And that's actually, I mean, now you said you didn't actually get a chance to experience being up on the Eiffel Tower. I mean, that is, I think, part of what is so unique about it and why it's still so beloved to this day, is that when you go up into the tower, I mean, you're really experiencing both this structure, which is completely original to this day, but you're also out in the elements. So it's a kind of a wonderful combination of things, and you're very high up in a way that feels very different than when you're in a solid building.
So what is it about the structure and the materials of this thing that made it so different, or why is it still standing today, 121 years later, or whatever it is?
Well, so it was made, I think there are 18,000 pieces. You just have to think of it as a big, giant 3D puzzle.
Rector set.
And, I mean, it took them 2 years to design all those pieces, because remember, every piece had to fit into the next piece, and they were different. So that it was largely prefabricated in Eiffel's factory, and then they would bring these giant, I mean, many-ton pieces to the site, and they had these teams of riveters, and they would then rivet it together. But you can imagine, I mean, what a process this was. And Eiffel was there every step of the way, and he had to devise all these very ingenious methods to get these really heavy pieces up. So there were literally almost straight up railroad tracks going up, and that those railroads then hauled these pieces up. But it was complicated, because they always had to be sure that each piece that was being attached was the correct piece. And they were in a huge race against time because they started later than they hoped, and the fair opened in early May of 1889. And they did finish the tower in time, but you really couldn't ascend all the way to the top until almost a month after the fair started because they were having a lot of trouble getting the elevators to work.
Well, you mentioned that, Eiffel seemed to have a bit of an artist eye when it even comes to the designing of a railroad bridge, but it did cause a number of critics to question whether he was the guy to pull this off, given the fact that he was not known for these kinds of structures. And then there was his experience in Panama. Do I understand that he failed down there in an attempt to do what?
Well, just to quickly address Panama, I mean, the only reason he failed in Panama was because they ran out of money. I mean, his design of what they called liquid locks would have worked, but he never was able to finish them. So that's and he was actually building that at the same time as the Eiffel Tower, but you know they just pulled the plug on it, so to speak, and so that was that. But in terms of the criticism, so I actually just have to read you this one little thing. It's all, I always love this. So what happened is Eiffel won this contest, and there were a lot of artists and literary people and so forth who really hated what the Eiffel Tower looked like, and to them it just looked hideous and industrial. Remember, this is Belle Epoque, Paris. There's a little, you know, everything is very sort of refined and flowery and ornamented and what have you. So this looked nothing like any of these things. In fact, if you've seen Eiffel's railroad bridges, I mean, it definitely had a strong resemblance to that, but it was just standing up straight. So all of the you know, sort of cultural elite banded together and wrote this outraged letter, and I will just quote a little bit of you. They denounced the Eiffel Tower as this horror, a black and gigantic factory chimney crushing all Paris beneath its barbarous mass, and this is always the best part, which even commercial America would not have. So, you know, people thought it was going to be really ugly. It was just going to be this big, overbearing, odious column of metal. But in fact, once the tower began to rise, and it rose over a period of 2 years, I mean, people really came around. All of these critics who had just given Eiffel nonstop hard time in the papers and, you know, at various meetings and what have you, I mean, they all came around and they sheepishly acknowledged that this was, in fact, something really graceful and beautiful, and the experience of being on it was really sublime. Because just remember, most people had never been up very high, and even if you'd been up high on a mountain, that really wasn't the same as being up high on the Eiffel Tower above this city that you were very familiar with. I mean, one of the things that I found very amusing, and I, you know, I put into my book because I found it so amusing, was people describing, I mean, for the first time in their lives, what it felt like to look down and see that humans were the size of ants. Because, I mean, people had never been so high up, unless you'd been up in a balloon. I mean, this was very much the era of balloons, but not many people had been in balloons. So it was all viewed as a very humbling experience to look down so far on the earth and really sort of see how inconsequential everything looked.
Well, you have to have very stable footings in order to put up a structure like this, and I think you addressed that in your book. What were the particular challenges when it comes to, I guess, the soil and the challenges of building this thing below in order to support it above?
Well, so that was the other thing. This really irritated Eiffel because midway, you know, in the whole planning of this, they knew that they were going to put it near the River Seine on the Champ de Mars, which is, that means the field of war. And this was actually land, you know, belonged to the military. And furthermore, they had agreed to let Eiffel have the tower up for 20 years so he could recoup the cost of it, which was $1 million in American money. And when the military heard that the tower was going to be there 20 years, they said, no, you know, you can't just have it in the middle of the Champ de Mars. How will we, you know, have our military exercises? So they insisted that it be closer to the river. So all of a sudden, Eiffel is realizing that two of the feet are going to have to be really dug below water. And so in my book, I have some pictures, which you can see. And they're actually, some of them are on my website, too. And it shows you that it's this incredible stone foundation for the 4 feet of the tower, which are buried very, very deep. And so, you know, when you go, all you see is the metal. But all of that metal is anchored to very deep stone foundations that are then, you know, full of cement. So it was that, you know, that alone, just getting the foundations in was really laborious.
You're listening to Jill Jones. She's the author of Eiffel's Tower, the thrilling story behind Paris's beloved monument and the extraordinary World's Fair that introduced it. A construction project like this, especially in the late 19th century, you would not be surprised to hear that there was loss of life in building this thing, was there?
Yeah, but, you know, really relatively minor if you think, you know, of the perils of it. So one young man came up on the tower apparently with his girlfriend after work, and that, you know, didn't end well. He somehow fell off. And then there was a painter who was working on the tower, you know, painting it, and he fell down and lost his life. But so, you know, in that era when life was sort of viewed as cheap and there was lots of loss of life when you were building big, you know, projects, whether they were railroads or whatever, I mean, I think that this was viewed as a fairly safe and successful enterprise, and, mm-hmm. you know, from that point of view.
Did he have any labor issues during the project?
Yes. Well, you know, the French are very organized and very hold their rights dear. And so as the, you know, they were really under pressure to get the tower done, and it was very, very cold up there. So at various points when the men felt that they should be paid more and that it would be really disastrous for Eiffel if, you know, they walked off the job, I mean, they went on strike and did, in fact, do better for themselves. And then after that, you know, once they sort of had what they wanted, then their relations were very good and they all went all out. And one of the things you see when you go to the Eiffel Tower is that all of the names of the men who worked on the tower, which was about 200, are actually inscribed on the tower itself to, you know, to honor them.
Well, we know, of course, that the Eiffel Tower opened up the 1889 World's Fair. What were the French trying to prove by the 1889 World's Fair? Because in a sense, that's the other half of your book. And I don't mean to mislead our readers. It's not as though there's two halves to your book. You've integrated the Eiffel Tower well into the fair itself and some of the crazy characters that found their way over from America. They're not all crazy, but interesting characters, let's say. So what were the French trying to prove? And then we're going to talk about some of these folks who came over and who we all know so well from history.
Well, what the French were really trying to prove was that the Republic was a success. The fact is that they were sort of on rocky times, and they really wanted to sort of display themselves to the world as a successful democracy. Now, one of the things I note in the book is so the fair occupied 229 acres, and it was, you know, really a glorious feast for the eyes and ears and senses, and I mean, people just love this. And what happened is, because this was the celebration of the downfall of the Bastille, and therefore, you know, kings and queens lost their heads, all of the other countries in Europe, which were monarchies, officially boycotted it. That really left the French to largely fill the fairgrounds as they would. And the way they did that was by introducing Europe to their colonies. So they just really recreated all of these other places, Egypt, various African countries, various Asian countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, so that you had these villages. And then there were many countries around the world that, you know, were not monarchies, the French monarchies, or, you know, the surrounding monarchies. And they all set up their own compounds so that you could go to this fair and really experience cultures from all over these other continents. And that was really fantastic. And at the same time, from the United States came, as we mentioned before, Buffalo Bill, because he thought this would be a great opportunity for the Wild West show. And, you know, most of Europe had never laid eyes on a cowboy, much less a Sioux Indian. And they just loved. This is the era when people are hunters, and everyone's still on a horse. So to see this kind of riding and bronco busting and the Indians riding bareback and being able to do all kinds of amazing tricks and the sharpshooters, people like Annie Oakley, I mean, the French and the other people who were coming to this fair, of which there were many tens of millions in the course of this summer, absolutely adored Buffalo Bill and this whole group of Westerners who came with him. And Buffalo Bill really became the most beloved American in Paris since the days of Benjamin Franklin. And the odd, you know, crossing of paths. So Paul Gauguin, the, you know, who we all know is a very famous French painter. You know, people really love his paintings that he did when he was out in Tahiti. So he was trying to get some attention at the fair. He was not in any way allowed to be in the official French art exhibit because he was an unknown. He got his paintings put up in a little cafe that had a Russian female orchestra that obstructed the view of his paintings. But he just was enamored of this fair and, you know, was thrilled to go and see these Javanese dancers who had been brought in from Indonesia. And he loved the Buffalo Bill show, and he went and bought himself a Stetson hat, which apparently, you know, he took up to wearing after that.
Now, that would be something to see.
Yeah, really.
And a self-portrait.
And when Edison came, so Edison was busy promoting his improved talking phonograph. And again, you know, to put yourself back in this time and place, no one, by and large, had ever heard recorded sound. So to be able to go to Edison's exhibit and listen to someone speaking or a song being played, I mean, people view this as akin to a miracle. And people stood in line for hours for the opportunity to spend 3 minutes at one of Edison's machines listening. So when Edison came over very unexpectedly with no prior announcement in August to the fair, the French viewed this as just a complete sign of the success and importance of their fair. And when he came, oh, lo and behold, Eiffel invited him, because remember, Eiffel is an engineer and Edison is an engineer also, to come to the Eiffel Tower and meet the French Society of Civil Engineers, which, of course, Edison did, bringing his phonograph. And Eiffel had a very lovely apartment at the summit of the Eiffel Tower. And then they went up. He took Edison up there, and Edison had his very young and lovely second wife with him. And they invited all kinds of important people, including the pianist and composer Gounod, who was playing the piano for Edison. So there just were these amazing crossings of paths. And I should also say, the very first time that Edison went to the top of the Eiffel Tower, who did he encounter there but the Buffalo Bill Indians?
Well, you mentioned another expat that is a fascinating guy. I frankly wasn't aware of him in history. James Gordon Bennett.
Oh, my goodness.
Publisher of the New York Herald. Is that the guy that really started what is today, when you go to Europe and pick up an English-speaking newspaper, the International Herald Tribune? Is that the descendant?
That is James Gordon Bennett, and he is truly one of the great characters of all time. I did not know him either, and I must say, I couldn't believe my good fortune that he walked across this stage, because the Herald, which, you know, is really sort of forgotten as a newspaper in this country, was at the time, you know, the most powerful paper and hugely lucrative. So, and he was a playboy and a, you know, really bon vivant, who was, you know, engaged in a lot of bad behavior and owned, you know, many houses and villas and yachts and, you know, but he was an extraordinary publisher. So he was a wonderful character, and he started the paper so it would be up and running, the international version of the New York Herald, the European edition, so it would be up and running in time for the fair. And he ran his New York paper from Paris through the cables. He was both admired and feared as a boss. You would get these cables from him saying, "Come over, I want to see you." So the trembling editor would, you know, get on the steamship and head all over to Paris, and he'd show up in Bennett's office on the Champs-Élysées, and one of Bennett's many eccentricities was he was obsessed with owls, and so his entire office, there would be hundreds and hundreds of owls of every shape and sort, and so the trembling employee would come in because it was known that Bennett liked to fire people in person, and he also always had with him a big coterie of tiny dogs. And so he would look up at this employee and say, well, what are you doing here? And he'd say, well, you sent for me. And he'd go, go home.
Well, I won't tell the story, and you probably can't either, but I was reading your book and laughing at one point. My wife said, what are you laughing at? And it was the moment when he had finally committed this significant indecency at the home of a friend, and that was when he was basically sent abroad as an expat when nobody would have him back in New York City. But that's a pretty funny scene.
Horsewhipped and in a duel before he left.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's just an amazing, amazing story.
One of his many escapades. And I should say that he is that rare American who has a street named for him in Paris because, I mean, while he did have this wild side, he was, you know, really a devoted newspaper man. And during World War One, he kept his paper running. I mean, many of the French had shut their newspapers and fled, but he kept the Herald going, and he published the front page both in French and in English. And the French were always eternally grateful to him for staying put and continuing to let people know what was happening.
Mm-hmm. So at the end of the fair, was it a financial success, considering the fact that the European nations didn't exactly play a role?
It was a triumph. Though they had no official presence, the fair was one of the great fairs of all times. And so it was a huge challenge to the Americans to manage to do something comparable, which I think they certainly did in Chicago in 1893. But moreover, the Eiffel Tower was a vast success and paid itself off financially by the end of the summer, leaving Eiffel with another 20 years of pure profit and trying to figure out how to save his tower from being taken down. And very quickly, what it all came down to in the end was it was of military value once radio got around.
Military value?
Yeah, because
the towers, the antennae on the top?
Right. The radio could operate at the top, and so they could find out what was going on in their far-flung colonies, and that was really invaluable. And there was nothing anywhere as tall that could broadcast so clearly.
It's just an incredible story, and again, some really funny things go on in that book that are best reserved for our readers, so I'll remind them again that the book is Eiffel's Tower, The Thrilling Story Behind Paris's Beloved Monument and the Extraordinary World's Fair that Introduced It. Jill, I really appreciate your joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, and it's just fun to relive that whole story because it was just such a pleasure to work on it and spend time with all of these people that we've heard of and not heard of and all mingling in this really lovely site.
Are you going to tell us another monument story soon?
No, I think that was so wonderful. I just felt as if that was going to satisfy my own desire to write about a monument.
Sure, sure. Well, Jill Jones, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Jill Jones. Next week, Michael Mandelbaum, author of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, researched by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.